Today is Tuesday, June 16th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a landmark U.S. Supreme Court ruling delivers a victory for the LGBTQ community.
He took the word because of sex and said that that includes not only whether you are male or female, but any kind of discrimination that has a sex-based component.
Protests ramp up following the death of another black man by a white police officer. Also ahead, will a high-level meeting this week between U.S. and Chinese officials calm escalating tensions? It's all on today's International Edition. The U.S. Supreme Court has delivered a major victory to the LGBTQ community amid concerns over an erosion of their rights in recent years. The conservative-controlled court ruled Monday that employers cannot discriminate against workers who are gay, lesbian, or transgender. It comes as the Trump administration has back a number of LGBTQ rights. It was a defeat for the president, who told reporters he accepts the court's decision.
Some people were surprised, but they've ruled, and we live with their decision. That's what it's all about. We live with the decision of the Supreme Court. Very powerful, a very powerful decision, actually. But they have so ruled.
Joining us to talk more about this landmark ruling and how the justices came to the decision is Dr. Paul Schiff Berman, Walter S. Cox Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School. Thank you for being with us. Can you tell us why the justices came to this conclusion and the opinion that they gave?
This was a statutory question having to do with the Civil Rights Act and particularly Title VII, which has to do with employment discrimination. And that was a broad remedial statute that Congress passed in order to prevent all kinds of discrimination in employment. And one of the provisions says that it bans any discrimination in employment because of sex. And the question was, what does because of sex encompass? Now, Justice Gorsuch, writing for the majority, took the position that because of sex includes not only whether you are male or female, but also your sexual orientation and to the extent that you have transitioned from one sex to another, that would also be a basis for discrimination on the basis of sex. Justice Gorsuch, he took the word because of sex and said that that includes not only whether you are male or female, but any kind of discrimination that has a sex-based component. And so it includes sexual activity, it includes gender reassignment, and so forth.
What was the dissenting argument?
The dissent's argument was that Congress says there's no discrimination because of sex, but that if you are discriminating on the basis of, for example, sexual orientation, that's not necessarily making a discrimination because of the sex of the person, because it would apply to gay men and lesbians equally. So the dissent, in contrast, took the position that what the Congress that enacted the statute meant was to focus on only discrimination based on being male or female. So in the end, the case really came down to whether you look at the text as it exists or whether you look at the intent of the Congress that wrote that statute in the first place.
What kind of implications for future cases could this ruling have?
Well, the biggest implication in the near term is that the statute will continue to be interpreted as it has been in most of the lower courts to bar employers from discrimination against gays and lesbians and transgendered people. And it means that Congress does not have to go back and try to amend the statute to do that. With regard to the Supreme Court and its jurisprudence going forward, it suggests that there is a solid majority for a textualist approach to statutes and not necessarily an approach that only focuses on the intent of the drafters originally.
For someone who doesn't know what you mean by textualist approach, could you explain what you mean by the approach that the court is taking?
So a textual approach looks at the statute or the constitutional provision as written and tries to interpret what those words mean now. An originalist approach looks at what those words might have meant or what the drafters might have intended them to mean at the time they were originally drafted. So the majority simply looked at the word sex and said sex includes sexual orientation, whereas the dissent looked at, well, what did the Congress that wrote the word sex mean at the time they wrote that word?
Were you surprised by the court's decision?
I think what it shows is that we can't necessarily assume that judges appointed by Republicans always rule a particular way and judges appointed by Democrats always rule a particular way. Judges make decisions based on jurisprudential factors and interpretive styles that don't necessarily map onto easy political categories.
Dr. Paul Schiff Berman, Walter S. Cox, professor of law at the George Washington University Law School. Thank you for being with us. Thousands of demonstrators calling for an end to police brutality marched for a third straight day across the city of Atlanta Monday, days after police fatally shot Rayshard Brooks, a black man who had fallen asleep in the drive-thru at a Wendy's restaurant. The killing inflamed the continuing tensions across the country over racial injustice that hit a boiling point just 3 weeks ago following the death of George Floyd in police custody. Well, as the protests continue across the country and in Washington, D.C. against racism and police brutality, it's nearing a fourth consecutive week, and a loose network of volunteers in Washington have formed to supply food, water, and medical care for demonstrators. VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to some of those people working to help keep the activism going, and he files this report.
The month of June is the start of summer in America. That means hot, humid weather in places like Washington, D.C., but so far, the summer heat has not meant an end to the anti-racism protests that have rocked America's capital for the last 3 weeks. That's in part thanks to a loose network of volunteers who are spending their days at the ongoing demonstrations near the White House. They hand out free food, water, and other supplies to protesters in hopes of keeping the movement going for as long as it takes to bring change. One of those volunteers, who gave her first name Davida, has helped set up a collection of tables, tents, and hammocks on the north end of Washington's Lafayette Square, which has been the epicenter of protests here.
We have waters, Gatorades, we're doing children's juice boxes, applesauce pouches, snacks. We have hand sanitizer and masks. We're trying to keep people educated about the pandemic as well. We've had people donate cloth masks and surgical masks. We also have all kinds of first aid supplies. We keep.
They even have an open-air tent with electric fans and ice packs in case anyone overheats while protesting. Davida says it started out as a medical effort, helping treat people who were tear-gassed or otherwise injured during clashes with police.
And then it kind of just gained momentum. We started asking our friends for help and donations, and we were live streaming a lot to make sure everyone knew what was going on. And people just wanted to help, so it kind of grew from there. We brought in thousands of dollars of donations. People have come daily to bring us deliveries of ice and food. This has been a community set up completely. We're not with any organization. We're not with any other one else. We're just a bunch of people from the area, from this community, that just want to see change. And we want to help people who are here to see the change. You know, we want to make sure their voices stay heard as long as possible. And so we want to make sure everyone's okay.
Nearby is another tent with some grills where volunteers cook hundreds of meals each day to hand out for free to protesters. 33-year-old John is grilling hot dogs.
I grew up here locally in the service restaurant industry. So one thing I do know is that people love to eat and they always love great food. So I definitely know that one thing that you could contribute to a great cause is giving food to people to make sure that the fighters out here and the soldiers out here that are fighting for the oppressed people have something fuel so that they can keep going and keep fighting for that same energy. Because we all have the same message, and it's community. That's essentially the message behind all of this, it's community. So this is how I contribute to my community, by giving food. I've worked in the service industry for years as a waiter and in the back kitchen as well. So one thing that we know is we know how to cook food and serve it in a safe manner to people. So that's why we chose to take on this task. We know the proper precautions to make sure that the food is safe, the temperatures, the amount of sanitization that it needs. So that's why we say we need to do it for the people. So, you know, everybody, we don't want anybody to get sick. So that's why we chose to take this task on.
John says everything they've given out comes from donations from well-wishers, many of whom support the protests, but fearing the coronavirus pandemic, aren't able to come demonstrate themselves.
You know, everybody wants to pitch in. So it's amazing. It's overwhelming. It's very, you know, heartwarming to see everybody giving back to, you know, help everyone feed. They donate the grills. You know, people help donate money for the food so that we can feed everybody. We just have to be here to cook it.
Not all the volunteers are so well structured. There are also individuals or small groups of friends giving out supplies, like Nyotin Danga, who stood in front of Lafayette Square recently with a group of friends handing out water bottles.
We're all a group of friends, and we're not part of any organization or social group. We just wanted to help the community the best way that we could. And we thought that if we could get some water, get Gatorade, get some snacks, be able to pass it out to protesters who are actually out here fighting for our rights, then that's the best way that we can to give back to our community as Black women. You know, this is the time of change. This is the time of the revolution starting. And anything that we could do to help make that happen, we want to do. So we thought this would be the best way of our contribution.
For Nyoti and so many other volunteers like her, supporting the protests is her way of bringing change. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Washington.
Protests demanding racial justice have spread globally. And for only the fourth time in the UN Human Rights Council's 14-year history, delegates attending the 43rd session will hold an urgent debate Wednesday on the issue. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The request for the racism debate was made in a letter signed by more than 50 African nations to the president of the council, Austrian Ambassador Elisabeth Tichy Fisselberger. The letter states the death of George Floyd is not an isolated incident, noting other people of African descent have suffered the same fate due to what authors of the letter say is unchecked police brutality in the U.S. The African countries are calling on the Council to urgently address the systemic racism that produces such racial violence, particularly against people of African descent throughout the world. Tichy Fisselberger tells VOA discussions will not just focus on one country, but will examine racism elsewhere.
When I said it's not against the United States, I mean there is complaints about a lot of racism in many countries of this world, of course in Europe, but not only. You find it all over the world. And if you listen to what people have to say, I think they will just come up with statements on describing different situations in different countries.
Both delegates and non-governmental organizations will take part in the UN Human Rights Council debate. A resolution is likely to be adopted at the end of the event. Tichy Fisselberger says the United States, which is not a member of the council, normally does not attend council meetings. She says U.S. delegates most likely will follow the debate via webcast, which is in line with what it has been doing recently. The U.S. has not commented. However, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. in Geneva, Andrew Bremberg, issued a statement last week expressing horror, anger, and grief at what he called George Floyd's senseless death. He said the public reaction in the U.S. following this tragedy showed the American people's desire to overcome racial injustice. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo plans to meet a Chinese delegation at a U.S. military base in Hawaii this week to discuss bilateral ties amid heightened tensions that have been recently exacerbated by anti-U.S. propaganda from China's state-controlled media outlets. The world's top two economies have been at odds over trade, the coronavirus pandemic, and China's new security legislation in Hong Kong. Joining us to discuss is Dr. Roy Denny, Senior Fellow and U.S.-China Relations Expert at the East-West Center in Honolulu, Hawaii. Thank you for being with us. So who is Secretary Pompeo planning to meet with, and how significant is this meeting?
Reportedly, he's meeting with Yang Jiechi, who's a former foreign minister and now has moved on to an even higher ranking position. So the Chinese are treating it as a pretty serious meeting. You could say that U.S.-China relations have, you could say, three dimensions: a strategic dimension, an economic dimension, and an atmospheric tone of the relationship dimension. And all three of those dimensions are in a downturn at the moment.
So why now? Is this politically driven, given that this is an election year? Why do you think this is happening now?
Well, first of all, the relationship being in such a trough is reason enough for the two countries to understand that they still need each other. They still need a constructive relationship, and they need to get the relationship back on the track where they can at least cooperate on issues of common concern. But even that's in danger at this point because there's been such a deterioration this year. But when you say politically motivated, I think you mean domestic politics.
Correct.
Certainly, it's an advantage for both the Chinese government and the U.S. government in front of their respective domestic audiences to appear to be capable of managing this important relationship well. And it's especially valuable if both of them can argue to their domestic audiences that they got a win. So the real challenge here will be, after the meeting, both sides to be able to go home and say, I got some progress from the other side on an issue that's important to us. But of course, it's difficult for one to win without the perception of the other losing. That's where the political gamesmanship comes into play.
What issues do you think will be highest on the agenda to try to resolve, and are they actually feasible?
There's some important political / strategic issues that need discussing. Hong Kong is probably at the top of the list, but also North Korea. The United States and China have sort of gone their separate ways on North Korea over the last year or so. The Taiwan issue is, again, becoming more salient, as there's at least a perception that, based on a lot of media reports, that China is getting a step closer to seriously considering military action. But I think that the issue where there's the greatest likelihood of progress being made is the economic issue, particularly picking up the pieces of the phase one of the U.S.-China bilateral trade agreement.
Do you think that's something that can be accomplished?
I think that's a feasible goal because it's in the interest of both countries to get the situation back to at least an even keel. With both countries facing some economic difficulty as a result of the pandemic, especially, to not have the additional problem of an upsetting of supplies and supply chains with such an important economic partner, it really becomes important in domestic politics of both countries. Also, it's an area where both sides can sort of claim a win.
It's interesting you mentioned the pandemic, of course, because we've been hearing the Trump administration blaming China quite a bit for this. I know that angered China quite a bit.
Generally, when there's a meeting like this, both sides will make their own opening statement, and I don't know that the rhetoric will get put aside. Both will have an opportunity to sort of vent, but then beyond that, once they state their basic grievances with the other side, that's when the real work begins. It's a matter then of crafting some areas where they can cooperate and agree, despite not everything being fixed at that atmospheric level, including the acrimony over the pandemic.
And what about the contentious Hong Kong law? Will Chinese officials even be willing to discuss that?
I expect that will be one of the areas where both sides offer an opening position that seems to offer no room for accommodation by the other side. They're completely irreconcilable. But beyond that, with the Hong Kong issue, there's actually some room for moderation on both sides. That is, the Chinese could interpret and implement the new law on national security very strictly and very expansively, in such a way that creates a lot of additional political problems. Or they could leave it at sort of a symbolic stage, at least for now, not press on the accelerator, get the law passed, very cautious about how they implement. And on the U.S. side, the options range from the United States completely disavowing any special relationship that Hong Kong has with the United States and treating it just like every other part of China for all purposes. But on the other hand, the United States has the option of standing pat with the tough speech that President Trump made, that we might do certain things, but then actually implement augmenting our retaliation for what the Chinese are doing in a very limited and targeted, even symbolic way.
We've been hearing a lot about how China has taken advantage of the unrest here in the United States over some of the racial injustice, police brutality issues. Would you agree with that, that China is capitalizing on that?
The answer is absolutely yes. The Chinese are taking advantage of the turmoil in the United States over the issue of racially motivated police brutality. I see it as a continuation of the place that the Chinese had got to in the rhetorical battles with the United States during the pandemic. The Chinese started out sort of in defensive mode, and then as they perceived they're being attacked by the United States government and other countries, and then they moved to a more offensive mode. And where they ended up at the end of May was frequently raising the idea that the United States, based on its pandemic response in the United States and its accusations of China as being the source of the disease and not handling it well and causing more problems for the rest of the world, which the Chinese are very unhappy about. The Chinese outward-reaching diplomacy latched onto the theme of the U.S. pandemic response proving that the United States is not fit to be a world leader. And the disturbances in the United States now and the attention given to police brutality has now given the Chinese a lot more fodder, which they have used to continue that argument, specifically that the United States talks a lot about human rights, criticizes human rights, particularly in China, but the United States is hypocritical in doing this because we now see that the United States is full of problems itself. Therefore, it ought to not only stop raising these issues with other countries, but shrink from its claims to international leadership on this or other issues.
Dr. Roy Denny, senior fellow and U.S.-China relations expert at the East-West Center in Honolulu, Hawaii. The body of the pilot of a U.S. Air Force jet that crashed off the British coast Monday has been located. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Hours after the crash, it says the pilot was found dead. Britain's Coast Guard had found the jet's wreckage earlier. The pilot had taken off on a routine training mission from Royal Air Force Base Lakenheath, which hosts the U.S. Air Force's 48th Fighter Wing. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is revoking its emergency authorization for malaria drugs promoted for treating the coronavirus. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
President Trump has been promoting hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine and had revealed he took hydroxychloroquine preemptively against infection.
A lot of people are taking it. A lot of doctors are taking it. A lot of people swear by it. It's gotten a bad reputation only because I'm promoting it.
The FDA cited reports of heart complications, saying the drug's unproven benefits do not outweigh the known and potential risks. The move means hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine will no longer be distributed to state and local health authorities for use against the coronavirus. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Voice of America director Amanda Bennett and her top deputy Sandra Sugawara resigned on Monday, saying that Michael Pack, the newly appointed chief executive of VOA's parent organization, the U.S. Agency for Global Media, has a right to replace them with his own VOA leadership. In their resignation letter, Bennett and Sugawara, who've been overseeing VOA since 2016, credited the hundreds of writers, broadcasters, editors, and technical staff that they say changed the agency for the better over the last 4 years. Global cases of the novel coronavirus reached over 8 million on Monday as infections surged in Latin America, and the United States and China have grappled with fresh outbreaks. The U.S. still leads the world with the highest number of infections, about 2 million or 25% of all reported cases. However, the outbreak is growing the fastest in Latin America. President Donald Trump said Monday he will be cutting the number of U.S. troops in Germany to 25,000, faulting the close U.S. ally for failing to meet NATO's defense spending target and accusing it of taking advantage of America on trade. The reduction of about 9,500 troops would be a remarkable rebuke to one of the closest U.S. trading partners and could erode faith in a pillar of post-war European security that U.S. forces will defend alliance members against Russian aggression. Jordan's King Abdullah could be facing the most serious decision of his 21 years on the throne should Israel follow through with plans to annex part of the West Bank on July 1st. As only one of two Arab peace partners,
Partners with the Jewish state analysts say such a move by Israel would spark a volatile reaction from Jordan's own population. And as Dale Gavlak reports from Amman, it would also mark the end of a potential two-state solution, an issue the monarch has vowed to resolve in the decades-long Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Jordanian analyst Osama El-Sharif is watching opposition grow within neighboring Israel to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's pledge to annex some 30% of the West Bank, which it has occupied since 1967, including Israeli settlements and areas populated mainly by Palestinians. The Palestinians have condemned any annexation, urging the international community to impose sanctions on Israel and to bilaterally recognize Palestine as a state. El-Sharif says members of Israel's Unity Cabinet, society, and even some Jewish settlers, as well as former generals and security officials, have warned of the political costs and threats to Israel's long-term security. Others oppose the plan devised by U.S. President Donald Trump because it also calls for a Palestinian state. El-Sharif tells VOA that Netanyahu may have to revise his proposal.
It seems now we are talking about quote-unquote annexation light, which is a much reduced version from the one that Netanyahu was actually proposing. Netanyahu is cherry-picking, taking what he wants from Trump's peace plan and leaving the rest. If it happens on 1st of July, it will be very symbolic. It might be limited to extending sovereignty over a couple of Israeli settlements that surround Jerusalem. It almost certainly excludes the Jordan Valley at this stage. So the whole thing is going through a change of direction because of division.
Last month, Jordan's King Abdullah pointedly told the German Der Spiegel magazine that if Israel really annexes the West Bank in July, it would lead to a massive conflict with the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. He said he was studying all options. Bruce Rydell, a Brookings Institution senior fellow in Washington, says those could include annulling Jordan's 1994 peace treaty with Israel, along with security agreements, as well as ending an unpopular $10 billion natural gas deal with Israel, or withdrawing Jordan's ambassador from Tel Aviv. Meanwhile, Jordan has pursued intensive diplomacy to try to preempt annexation. International pressure is also bearing down. Germany has called Israel's planned annexation contrary to international law and its prevention a priority. The United Arab Emirates ambassador to Washington, Yusuf Al-Otaiba, warned Israel that annexation will immediately upend Israeli aspirations for improved ties with the Arab world and the UAE. Al-Sharif says King Abdullah has toned down his rhetoric because he's also watching Israeli discussions on the annexation issue.
Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, UAE all express different levels of the rejection of annexation and its dire consequences on stability and on the region, not to mention the Palestinian reaction as well.
Jordan and other Arab states believe annexation will shut the door permanently on a viable future Palestinian state and could spark Palestinian violence. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
And finally today, Beyonce is joining the call for charges against police officers involved in the fatal shooting of Breonna Taylor, a black woman gunned down by officers who burst into her Kentucky home on March 13th. The officers have been placed on administrative reassignment while the shooting is investigated. Taylor was 26 years old and studying to become a nurse when she was shot 8 times by officers conducting a narcotics investigation. No drugs were found at her home. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be right back.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.